Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to open up the House Committee on Veteran Services and Emergency Preparedness. Today is February 3rd. Thank you all to the hundreds in attendance and the millions of viewers at home. Appreciate you joining us today. It's true, Representative Escobar.
Well, yeah, I believe that, too.
As you know, February is going to run rather quickly, and things will fly at the speed of light. We have put possible work sessions on a lot of our bills. That doesn't mean they're going to move today. Some things need amendments. We realize that, but we're still excited to hear everybody's testimony. But before that, we have a matter of housekeeping, which is we need to adopt the committee rules. And so with that, I will refer to my vice chair, Representative Fagan.
Chair Matthews, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated today, February 4th, 2014.
Thank you very much. Representative Fagan moves to adopt the proposed committee rules today, dated today. Is there any discussion? And are there any changes to the committee rules that we should be aware of?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the only heads up that we got from the chief clerk, differences in the model committee rules, or the accelerated timelines, particularly as it applies to minority reports. That's rule number 15. Instead of 48 hours after giving notice to the chair and to the committee of your intent to file a minority report, you have until 5 p.m. of the day of the meeting. So if you're adjourning at 5 o'clock, 5 p.m. the day after. The rest is a reminder only, not a change, about the requirement to announce conflicts in committee and then provide your a notice in writing. Otherwise, it's exactly the same based on the model rules and identical in each committee.
Wonderful. Thank you for that. And with that, is there any further discussion? Seeing none, any objections? Seeing no objection, the motion passes. The rules are adopted. Thank you for that. And our committee remains unchanged as we were in the regular session 2013, so we remain the same committee. I think we will forego the introductions of the folks, if that's okay with my committee, as we have a lot of testimony, a lot of invited testimony as well. Did I just see...
Representative Gorsuch.
Pardon?
Representative Gorsuch.
Oh, I see Representative Gorsuch. I'm ignoring him. My neighboring district. So with that, I was looking for Dr. Holliday, and I don't believe he is next door testifying. And so with that, and I want to sure compliment, too, the great work of Ms. Cheyenne Ross, who does phenomenal work. She is actually administering how many committees? At least a
few. Mr. Chair, three.
Three committees. So multitasking, we appreciate that. And so what we'll do is we'll skip the order of House Bill 4021, and we'll open up a first public hearing on House Bill 4022. And I will pass the gavel, and if Representative Gorsuch would like to join me at the dais. Sure.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4022. Creates the Kelsey-Smith Act requiring cellular service to provide cellular device location information for the purpose of emergency response to situations involving risk of death or serious physical harm at the request of law enforcement. It requires cellular service registered in Oregon or subject to Oregon jurisdiction, provide emergency contact information by June 15th each year or when the information changes. It requires the Office of Emergency Management to maintain a database of cellular service emergency contact information for disclosure to public safety answering points, 911 centers, as specified in the measure, prohibits a cause of action against the cellular service complying in good faith.
Thank you. To my colleagues, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Fagan and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Greg Matthews. I am State Representative, House District 50, the great city of Gresham, bringing to you today a bill that I think is extremely important, that we're made aware of by a constituent who contacted me on Facebook, of all things, and it's somebody who follows the world of safety. And I want to take you back to a date of June 2nd of 2007 when a young gal went to a Target store in Kansas to purchase a birthday gift for her boyfriend. She exited the store, never to be seen again. That was on June 2nd. Apparently, there was some video surveillance tapes that would suggest that she was overcome by somebody who forced her into her own vehicle. They later identified the suspect vehicle as a Chevy pickup in the parking lot. But the bottom line is that police officers, law enforcement agencies became aware fairly soon that there was a real problem here and that there was, how they say, foul play. They requested what they call pinging of the phone, which would be a cellular phone that she had on her. And the ping is a way to determined location within a reasonable distance. Unfortunately, the cellular company, which I'll remain, it's nameless, you can Google it, but I'll just say that it wasn't until 4 days later that they gave the information to law enforcement. After having the information and what they were told was a ping location, they located her body 45 minutes later. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not suggesting that that the events that happened to Kelsey Smith on June 2nd of 2007 would have changed. I'm not saying that. I am saying, though, that within that 4 days, it's reasonable to assume that there could have been a better outcome. It's reasonable to assume that we could all do it better, could have done better. I have been, I want to say this. Telecommunications folks will testify, and I think for the most part some of them will say they're doing this. There are other states that have followed in this act. In fact, it went to Congress, who is trying to get this to be a federal act, and it hasn't happened yet. And it's actually gone to Canada as well. Currently, the states are Kansas, Nebraska, Minnesota, New Hampshire, North Dakota, Tennessee, Hawaii, and Missouri. So what does this mean? This doesn't mean that I can call and say, hey, is my wife still at the mall in Nordstrom's because that half-yearly sale should be over? Ping her phone and tell me if she's still there. Can't do that. But if there's evidence to suggest that somebody's intimate life danger, then they could. And law enforcement could request this information, and they could then give that to them. Now, there is a problem with the bill. Big surprise. You'll hear of these maybe throughout the month. But this problem has to do with the language that says reseller. There are some folks out there that they're not the provider of the contractual service to your phone, but they're a location that sells the phone. So as an example, if you're in rural Oregon, and there may be some in urban as well, but you may go to a shop where it's a mom-and-pop store that sells you a phone, and with that you get, just pull a name out, we'll say Verizon or Sprint. You get their contract, and you sign up for their contract. The mom-and-pop store is not the carrier at that point. They're not the ones that are going to be compelled by this law to come up with the coordinates for pinging the phone. That's not the intent of the law. So as soon as we can reclassify that language of reseller, I think we'll have a better bill. There's also some concern about the definitions of public safety, and we're going to work with that. So our intent is to get something here. We brought this in 2013, had some conversations. It was late in the session. As you know, constituents oftentimes call you. In fact, I got a call just prior to this committee of a bill idea that they had for this session. It doesn't work that way unless, you're elected to a higher position than we are. Then you can get whatever you want. But did I just say that?
You did.
Anyway, but the reality is we have to have the process. And this is one of those bills that I think has gone through process. I think other states have done it, and I think it makes very good sense. So with that, I would like to see us enact this in this legislation. I'm joined with my good friend. I'll let him introduce himself. Thank you.
Well, Chair Fagan and members of the committee, I am Chris Gorsak, representative for District 49, a next-door neighbor of Representative Matthews. I've spent a lot of time in a past life working for Portland Police, so I have a little bit of experience with this. You've heard a lot of the testimony that Representative Matthews gave, so I don't need to read all of this, and there are copies of it over here. I just want to say, first of all, that law enforcement is sometimes hampered when we cannot find people. And as in this bill, there's an attempt to address that. In the olden days before we had enhanced 911, we had a similar problem because you didn't have the address pop right up at the 911 facility. And so incomplete calls could be a serious issue. Well, here we have a similar sort of thing where we can fix this and allow for emergencies. And we are, as he said, not talking about just any old thing, but emergencies to be addressed in a very timely fashion. And in the case, for instance, with Kelsey Smith and others, time can be a huge factor in whether somebody is a fatality or we're able to respond and take care of the problem. So I just want to say that this is certainly an important bill, and we need to take every step that we can to ensure we don't have more preventable tragedies like the one that happened to Kelsey Smith. So on behalf of Kelsey Smith and other victims like her, I urge the passage of HB 4022.
Are there any questions or comments for this panel, Representative Huffman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Matthews, you intimated, or maybe I misunderstood, but something about you're working on definitions, or maybe some of the partners out in the room still have some input. Can you give me the status of that? And then kind of related to that, will we have testimony about exigent circumstances, warrants, things of that nature?
Chair Fagan and Representative Huffman, members of the committee, thanks for the question. Whether or not we'll have testimony on exigent circumstances, I don't know if they will be. If there will be, that'll be behind us. As far as the definition of reseller, we're trying to get that again. I don't know if it'll be taken out of the bill or if it'll be further classified as carrier of the contract. Again, it would be helpful, and I'll admit this being our bill, it'd be helpful to reach out to those folks in the industry prior to getting things drafted sometimes, because I think what this does is mirrors a lot of other states. But for some of our folks in the industry in this state, they would have liked to have been a part of it to help craft a better bill. That's what we're hoping to achieve with their involvement. I haven't been told by anybody that they hate this bill. There might be slight problems with the bill, but I think they can all be overcome, and we'll do that together. I should also point out that that the individual responsible for her death did plead guilty. He was arrested that very same day and pled guilty to four charges of kidnapping, rape, sodomy, and capital murder. So, but thank you.
Representative Escobar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What is going to determine, quote, the emergency? Because when you read that, it says life-threatening and or physical harm, I believe, something like that. Who determines that? That's a tough call.
Chair Fagan, Representative Escobar. That's
what I would think
question.
Would be emergency, she may not think so, and he would, and so on and so forth. So,
I think the way I view it, the way that I understand it, the intent anyway, is the immediate circumstance, threat to life or death. You know, I mean, and threatened of physical injury. I don't see this as somebody went out and they didn't come home, and there's nothing to suggest that they just didn't go to a friend's house, but more, you know, in the case, you know, in my law enforcement career where you have somebody who's missing after they've had a routine of behavior, right, and all of a sudden they got off work at 9 o'clock and now it's, you know, 12:30 and their car's still parked at their former employer and their purses scattered throughout the parking lot, those might be things to suggest. There may be somebody from law enforcement that could better answer that.
Also, Chair Fagan and Representative Escobar, the other thing that I would indicate is that the actual on-the-ground decision would inevitably be the 911 dispatcher, and they make those sorts of calls all the time in terms of the priority level that they give to the call. So I would assume that it would be the very same protocol, and people testifying behind me can confirm or deny this, but I would assume it'd be the same protocol, and so only in these very serious situations would this kick in.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Gentlemen, does your bill encompass such services as OnStar?
It's a great question, Chair Fagan, Representative Witt. I don't know that.
Okay. Thank you. Madam Chair, if there was an opportunity, I'm aware of an instance in my own district where access through OnStar, which was actually denied to the police, would have been exceedingly helpful.
And Chair Fagan and Representative Witt, members of the committee, if I could, I think one of the issues that you may run into is that OnStar, it's loaded into your vehicle. You get a 90-day trial, and in some cases, maybe up to a year, but then it's a subscription service that you need to subscribe to. I would imagine if you're not a subscriber of that service, they could still access that, but I would imagine they would not want to. Otherwise, why would you subscribe to a service that could be provided by compelling, you know, law enforcement?
Any other questions or comments for this panel? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I'm going to call, based on how people have indicated on the testify sheet, I'm going to call up a couple of groups that are kind of at a similar position. So first let's have Barb Young and Brant Wolf.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Brant Wolf. I represent the Oregon Telecommunications Association, and the OTA is our members are landline telephone companies. And the point that Representative Matthews made regarding resellers is exactly my point. I don't need to belabor it, but just for the record, some of our small companies do resell Verizon Wireless, and we really are not the ones you need to get in touch with in the event of emergency. You need to contact the underlying carrier. So that's our only issue with this bill. We're not opposed to it in any way. And we'll work with the committee administrator, Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair, Representative Matthews, to correct any language that needs to be corrected.
Chair Fagan, committee members, my name is Barb Young. I'm the legislative director for CenturyLink, and we have the same concern. We partner with Verizon Wireless so we can provide a full portfolio for our customers, but we're simply, I guess you could look at it as a billing agent for them. We would not have the location information, so it really does center around that definition of reseller, and we're happy to work on clarifying that. Thanks.
Are there any questions or comments for this panel? That was easy.
Thank you.
Thank you. So next I'm going to call up Daryl Fuller.
Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, if he's back in his position.
Here we go.
I get to be a panel all by myself. Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, also here on behalf of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. We support the legislation, understand the concern about invasion of privacy issues, which is encompassed in some other bills that we're going to be looking at during the process of the session. But I can tell you that when somebody dials 911 but nobody answers, or when the 911 operator answers a 911 call but there's nobody there, to be able to potentially ping that cell phone to find out where that person is, because perhaps they're in a trunk of a car and they've dialed 911 but they can't talk to you at that particular time, or somebody's in their house and so they don't feel like they can call you, that they can vocalize their concerns. There are circumstances, there's going to be a bill that you may see later this session on a silver alert where somebody who has dementia has perhaps wandered away from their facility. We know that their health is in danger because of the inclement weather and because of their physical condition, and they may have a cell phone on them. And to be able to get information on where that phone is could be very important in terms of literally meaning the difference between life and death. So as I read the bill, it would be requested by a law enforcement officer, and law enforcement officers have a pretty good sense based on their experience of training when they believe somebody's life or health may be in danger and when this information may be vital as part of either a criminal case or in the cases when it's not a criminal case but where they're simply trying to find somebody whose life may be in danger because of their condition. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, and we'd be happy to participate in any sort of group discussions on refining the language.
Thank you. Any questions of Mr. Fuller?
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. And next up, we could have Becky Strauss from ACLU, please. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Chair Matthews, members of the committee, my name is Becky Strauss. I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill. We are neutral on the bill, and also want to thank your staff, Zach Reeves, for the conversations that we've had leading up to the hearing. We absolutely recognize the importance of law enforcement having the tools it needs to protect public safety, and this is a good bill to build on existing authority to access location records in an emergency. Handing over very sensitive account records like location information, as a general rule, should be accompanied by a warrant requirement from law enforcement, and certainly imminent emergency situations are an exception to that rule, and I don't have any reason to believe that your intention is anything beyond, with this bill, the narrow instance of a pending emergency, and in that situation, we think it's more than appropriate to have lines of communication open between the cell providers and law enforcement to be able to address the public safety situation as quickly as possible. What I'm here to testify about is just one small language issue to flag, hoping for, I guess, either a little bit of clarity or asking the committee to consider striking it out. Section 1, subsection 5, talks about cell providers and the like establishing protocols to voluntarily disclose the call location information, and it seems that I'm not exactly sure the intention of this section, because in subsection 1 above, it talks about at the request of law enforcement in regard to a particular call that those channels of communication are open and that the cell provider provides that information. I'm worried about the notion of the cell provider on its own volition voluntarily disclosing information. I'm actually further worried that provision conflicts with federal privacy law. So if the committee is open to striking it altogether, that would be wonderful. If there is a reason that I'm not spotting for that provision, would love to work with you further and figure out how to narrow that a little bit. Thanks very much.
Thank you. And that's line 26, 27, and start at 28.
That's right.
Yeah. And Zachary's have done great work on this, and I appreciate you talking with him earlier today and voicing your concerns. And I think we had that discussion as well about that language. So, Zach, you're nodding your head. Are we having that discussion with LC and trying to figure this out? Thank you, sir. Appreciate that. And thank you. Are there any questions? Yes.
And I'm not sure if it's for Becky or you. And I apologize, I haven't read all the way through the bill. Where are the fail safes? Is there some type of logging procedure? I mean, I'm generally supportive, and I definitely see the benefit of the expediency of an emergency being able to have that ability. Where's the check and balance on it to make sure at some point that it's not being abused? Is there anything in there or any thoughts about that?
I will I'll field the question for you, sir. I think on this it simply is a matter of law enforcement to determine if it involves the risk of death or serious physical harm. I don't know that there's a fail-safe if somebody should abuse that. I don't anticipate this being abused. If it was, you know. But your question's noted, and I understand you're supportive, too. So
I just, a lot of people in the room know I work on a lot of the privacy issues in the House, and it's always a concern of mine to make sure that we don't abuse something that is in and of itself a grand idea.
Chair Matthews, if I may,
yes,
as long as I'm sitting here, might chime in. I agree. I'm not sure that there's a clear accountability piece to this bill, and I might suggest if stakeholders are open to it, some sort of reporting requirement or tracking. I imagine these are very limited instances when the situation would arise, so that it might not be too burdensome for either a cell provider or law enforcement or both to be keeping track of when they utilize this section and make sure that that's available.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any further questions, comments? Yes, Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this reminds me of something we ran into in rural fire departments responding to calls. We call it breadcrumbing. Sometimes you get a call of a logging accident just out there somewhere, and somebody's too rattled to tell you exactly where it is. They don't know, or the phone got thrown or whatever, and you got to get to them, and those logging roads aren't marked in a way that you and I, unless you know them, you can get through. So what we do is we throw down flagging tape, surveyor's tape, and hope to God the wind doesn't blow when you get to a break in the road. But the point is that these are, you know, they're time certain, especially in an injury, accident like that. You don't want to have to go for a warrant. You don't want to have to do all these things. It's just you have to get it done. And I think we're looking at this in the Oregon Resilience Plan, too, ways to waive some of the state rules that, you know, in day-to-day work we need and have and all that, and everybody agrees with for the most part. But these emergency cases, I think any way we can get to the patients or victims the fastest way and not worry about, you know, whether it's, you know, is somebody just trying to sneak up and do something devious. I think that it's the intent. I mean, I know you, and I know Representative Gorsuch, if he's still here, you're just trying to get that job done. You're trying to get the help to the person who needs it. And I think that vision of someone being in a trunk, I mean, I've seen it on movies and stuff like that, but there could be a case where you cannot verbalize, but you could push a button, and you could push your one button or whatever it is for the 911 call on a silenced phone, but you'd need to have that. So I hope that's considered in that.
Yeah, thank you. Any questions? Any further comments? Ms. Strauss, thank you.
Thank you.
And next up, Dave Stuckey and Mark Tennyson, please. Gentlemen, how are you doing?
Good afternoon. Chair Matthews, Vice Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Parrish, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Dave Stuckey. I'm the Director of the Office of Emergency Management. And as the office, the agency that would be the database owner and manager of this process, we believe this is an encouraging piece of legislation. We submitted a minimal fiscal on it. We believe we can handle this within agency resources, so we just wanted to get that on record that we believe this is a good piece of legislation. With me today is...
Good afternoon, Chair Matthews, Vice Chair Fagan and Parrish. For the record, I'm Mark Tennyson, also with the Office of Emergency Management, the Manager of Technology and Response, and the State 911 Program Manager as well.
And so... you had some follow-up on?
Yeah, Chair Matthews, Vice Chair Fagan and Parrish, at the indulgence of the Chair, one item that I wanted to suggest as far as some language would be under in Section 1, where it refers to law enforcement, perhaps thinking of law enforcement, also thinking about 911 response, which also includes fire, ambulance, and so forth, that perhaps that could be changed to public safety agency. Just as a suggested recommendation.
Well, Chair Matthews, you highlighted it up front. You may also want to consider, and we certainly will be a part of this if you so are inclined, but search and rescue may be a component in there that you may want to add. Someone suffering from Alzheimer's, walking away and needing some help is another option. So we're here to help, and we see this as a positive piece of legislation.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Comments for the panel? Seeing none, thank you, gentlemen.
All right, thank you.
Yes, absolutely. And that takes us through the sign-up list of everybody who signed up to testify on House Bill 4022. So we will close the public hearing on House Bill 4022 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 4023.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4023 establishes a lottery raffle game to benefit education and economic development for veterans. It requires the Oregon State Lottery Commission to create a game and the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development to create the corresponding program. It provides a dedicated accounting structure, declares an emergency, is effective on passage. There may be a couple of amendments. They are pending because this is a generous relating to clause relating to veterans. There is a revenue light and a fiscal light on the bill as introduced, not including any amendment, and it has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Great. Thank you for that. And I think we'll bring up the first panel, Gus Bedwell, Veronica Garcia, and Stephanie Cornes, please. And you can go in whatever order you'd like. Just please, introduce yourself for the record. And you've been here before, so welcome again.
Oh, okay. I was going to say ladies first, but they said let me start first. So, Chair Matthews, Vice Chair Parrish and Fagan, my name is Gus Bedwell with Oregon State University, and I work as a Veterans Resource Coordinator there. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to address House Bill 4023 and my role as a Veterans Resource Coordinator with Oregon State University. Based upon my experiences as a campus veteran service officer with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs and now as Veterans Resource Coordinator with Oregon State University, I believe I can offer a unique perspective on the importance of veterans advocates on campus. As you all know, in September of 2009, I became one of five of the campus veteran service officers with ODVA. As a campus veteran service officer, I was afforded many opportunities to support student veterans by helping them access and receive a wide range of VA benefits on top of their education benefits. All of the campus VSOs worked hard to connect with the universities and community college administrators, faculty, staff, and students. We marketed ourselves as enhancers to the services already offered by the hardworking and outstanding veteran certifying officials. Even though some of the areas of the state were more successful than others, the bottom line was that the Campus Veteran Service Officer Program changed the lives of student veterans in the way community colleges and universities viewed them. As we all know, the program came to an end June of 2011 due to lack of funding. Schools like Portland State University, Portland Community College, Oregon State University found funds to fill the void by creating Veterans Resource Coordinator positions. Fortunately for me, I was able to take my experience as a Veterans Advocate and become OSU's first Veterans Resource Coordinator. As a Veterans Resource Coordinator, I'm offered a lot of the same services, I offer a lot of the same services as I did as the campus VSO, with three clear differences. As a Veterans Service Officer with Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, I was an accredited Veterans Representative, meaning I could take a power of attorney and file a claim on behalf of veterans and their family members. I am no longer an accredited representative. However, because there are county and state VSOs locally in every county in Oregon, I can tap into their resources and still provide those services to veterans through their offices. As a VSO, I worked for Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. As a Veterans Resource Coordinator, I work for OSU. As an OSU employee, there are tools I have available to me now that could not be offered to me as an ODVA employee. Tools such as being a faculty senate member with direct contact with the faculty senate leadership on pertinent federal and state legislative changes. I'm able to work directly with academic advising committees and work groups and participate on search committees for future OSU employees, paving the way for future veterans to work at OSU. I also have access to student account information and other privileges guided by state and federal laws that are unavailable to non-OSU employees. The last thing is, as a VSO, I was responsible for multiple schools up and down the West Coast and the I-5 corridor. This continual moving from one place to another created some unique challenges when trying to continuously and effectively engage and stay connected with universities and community colleges. As a Veterans Resource Coordinator for OSU, I can now focus my attention on one school's student population. This concentrated focus, along with a dedicated team of professional faculty members and students across the campus, has afforded me the opportunity to see several successes for our students, such as a stronger relationship with the Portland and Roseburg VA Medical Center, creation of a Student Health Services Veterans Work Group, handing out of our military and veterans honor cords, recognition cords, two commencements in a row, and the signing of the DOD MOU by Oregon State University, which at the time allowed 115 TA recipients students to maintain their benefits. So see, since I have had an opportunity to work on both sides of the table helping student veterans, I can wholeheartedly tell you that being a university employee has had its advantages in my ability to support student veterans. My success, however, is reliant on the significant support and energy provided by students and staff involved in school-based work groups and advisory committees. These individuals amaze me on a daily basis on the work and initiatives they are willing to take on in support of student veterans. So in conclusion, I want to thank you for allowing me to offer my experiences today. I hope it helps in your decision to make a process, or making process, as you move forward with your work supporting one of our Oregon's greatest assets, and that's student veterans. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Good afternoon, Chairman Matthews and committee members. My name is Veronica Garcia. I'm the Dean of Student Affairs at Portland Community College. We're here in support of this House Bill 423. We have over 1,600 students, veteran students, that attend PCC, and although we are 100% committed to their educational endeavors, we realize there are other additional wraparound services that we cannot 100% provide. So having the VSOs on campus, it has been a tremendous asset for PCC, as well as we've created several resource centers where our veteran students can come and develop a sense of community. So I'm going to give up my time because we brought one of those veteran students here who actually works in the resource center and can talk to you about what the positive aspects have been for us with our resources. So Stephanie.
Good afternoon, Chairman Matthews. Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Stephanie Cornis, and I'm the Assistant Coordinator at the Veterans Resource Center at the Rock Creek Campus for Portland Community College. And I have a video that I'll have you direct your eyes to.
Oh, great.
And
looked like maybe the wrong seal was on there. Is that supposed to be Army or? Just kidding.
We're supposed to keep things civil, correct?
I could say something.
And why that? Do you mind while we're waiting? Tell us about your service.
Absolutely. I was in the Marine Corps for approximately 8 years. I got out of service about 2 years ago. Since then, I've been a full-time student. I work full-time, and I'm a single parent.
Well, thank you for your service. Appreciate that very much.
What's that? We are the onlookers of the traumatic incident. We are the victims of assault and the survivors of war. Our cabinets are lined with medications most people can't pronounce and have no knowledge of. Our beliefs have shifted, and we struggle finding ourselves in our place. We've forgotten race, class, and gender. We are all green. Our family and friends remember who we were and forget that we are changed. We fake our way through joyous events and public ventures. Our smiles rarely reach our haunted eyes. We live in the past and the present at the same time. Our minds move through time as though it does not exist. The past is always the present, and the present is always the past. We lose pieces of the present from moments in the past. Moments we want to believe are over, but are relived when another gives up. We will all struggle to exist until we die, our cracked armor held together by pride. Many of us will die of old age as life intended. Some of us will be taken by fate. And up to 5,000 of us a year will die by our own hand when we become weary of fighting an unending war. We've seen enough pain and hurt to engulf a lifetime, and a lifetime is all we have left. We are leading the future generation, but how? We are broken, weathered images of our former self. We will leave an imprint larger than the morals we possess. We are painfully aware of our mortality and the human capacity to adapt, survive, and overcome. But our history follows us like a slow plague, removing small pieces and important people until we are all there's left. Our symptoms are alike, but we are completely different. Our personal battles are different, but we fight the same disease. We have our own experiences and our own triggers, and most of us only sleep when we know we can't dream. We can be impulsive and self-destructive. People don't understand our emotions and our actions, and we will never share the dark part of our lives with them. We are a reminder of what the government and society are capable of. Our youth consumed, fighting a battle, uniting an empire to which we will never belong. Our hearts are heavy and our souls are broken, but our humanity remaining. Your tax dollars have funded our destruction. Some of us have become the angel of death, the taker of souls. Our rifles have made us gods among men. We have defended those we have never known, protected and avenged the innocent. We do not regret our decisions and life choices, but regretting something and living with them are different. All of the battles we have fought aren't half as brutal as the wars we rage on ourselves. We stand in reverence of our fallen and continue marching through life. We march on, hitting the ground almost as hard as it hits us back, leaving lacerated flags and buried dreams, preceded with white markers defining our forgotten graves. We have become lost in dust and sand, remnants of what we lack. We are your military, your Marines, your soldiers, your sailors, and your Navy. And although we are surrounded by others who suffer the same, we will stand in formation side by side, separated by an invisible wall. Our fight is in our minds, and we face it alone.
Wow.
Now, we all know that there is about 1.7 million active duty members that are separated from active duty as of now, that were in deployment with Operation Enduring Freedom, Operation Iraqi Freedom, and Operation New Dawn. Of those, 30% have been diagnosed with PTSD. We see it in our veteran population every day. Our resource center has taken a population of veterans and made a new community. Our dean used to see 2 to 3 students a week that were veterans before our resource center was in place. And now she's lucky if she sees 1 a semester for a behavioral issue, mainly because people don't understand. They don't get the masculine communication. They don't recognize the signs of PTSD. They don't recognize the signs of someone being transitioned from one medication to another. We're able to help our students with that. And we know when they're missing. We have probably 60 regular people that are in on a daily basis just to get coffee, hang out, say hi. It's made it to where our office, we have a new one now that we'll be moving into at the end of this month, because we're so busy that we can't fit everyone. It'll be five times the size, the office that we're in now. And our veterans definitely look forward to it. On top of all of those things, the main thing that we do is a social atmosphere, the camaraderie, safe space. We also have teachers who will email us and say, I have a student veteran that I believe is a concern. This is a class that they're in. If you come, maybe grab them after class, I would appreciate it. And we do our best to draw them into our community. And that's actually been very helpful. A lot of the students really appreciate it. We answer questions regarding educational benefits, as you're talking about. Certificate of eligibility, FAFSAs, where's my money? Why am I not getting my money? I'm stressed out because I don't have money. And we do everything that we can to connect them with community resources that can provide for them. We explain to them the VA healthcare system. I hound them until they go down and actually register. I'm like, did you do this yet? No, I haven't had time. Oh, well, you better make time because guess what? We're kind of like a parent overseeing them in some ways because we've been there so long and we know how to talk to them. Like, I can tell them that they're stupid and go do this because I don't want to put up with it. Like, just do it because I said to. And they're like, oh, all right, you know. There's not enough hours available for us to have advocates there because we don't have the funding for it. We're open from 9 to 6 on average, Monday through Friday. And the whole time we have people in there. We're open sometimes on Saturdays, and on Wednesdays we stay open till 7 to 7:30. There is not a time that you will walk into that office and find it empty normally. So that's my perspective. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much. And the powerful video is actually linked. Thank you, Ms. Ross, for having that. It's in our testimony, so you can find that video YouTube link. Who wrote Remember the Marines? Are those your words?
Yes, they are.
Amazing. Thank you from
the video was not compiled by me. The video was compiled by
But your words over the top. Now, do we have those words? Is there any way that you can provide it? Okay, we'll get that from you when you're done. Thank you so much. Outstanding. Questions?
Well, just a comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I'd like to thank you for your service and for proving that this is a good program. I've been working in this committee and its various permutations since I've been an elected state representative here. And the first time I heard about the need for this was way back when Sergeant Heyer came in and made his case. And I'm just so glad that it's happening, and I totally support it 100%, and I do wish that we could give you all you need, but I know that there's a tsunami of people coming back and going to deal with this problem, and it's very tough on you, but you're a good representative for them because you've been there, and I mean, I can't imagine going through what you have, so bless you.
Any further comments or questions for the panel?
Well, I'll just say, I appreciate you sharing that. I think every legislator needs to hear it. We know the need. Sometimes our colleagues don't know the need or trying to balance that with other needs. But the fact is it doesn't take a lot of money to get a high return on our investment for veterans. And when I think about the federal dollars that are available to our veterans, if we get them connected to the right programs, the work that you all are doing is absolutely critical. So I know that those of us on the committee, we understand that. We just have to do a really good job banging that drum to our colleagues.
Thank you for that. Any further? Yes, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Canis, did I pronounce that correctly?
Cornice,
excuse me.
You can correct him. Okay. I do all the time.
Yeah. thank you.
I don't really care.
thank you for your service. But your words were very, very powerful.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions or comments, thank you all for the work you're doing for Oregon's veterans, and thanks for your testimony today and your support. And if it's possible to email, that would be wonderful. If you want to just hand it over, we'll have somebody transcribe it. It's okay, but I think every legislator will get a copy of it, and I think at some point we'll probably want to give you due credit and read that on the floor. So thank you so much for what you've done and provided today, but your continued work and service excellence. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Matthew can grab a copy if she's willing to.
Oh, great. If we could have the copy. Matthew, can we get a copy?
She's willing to give that copy. You can take it right now.
Wonderful.
For being taped, you're probably not going to pull the audio.
And next up, we have Andy Smith, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Matthews, Vice Chair Parrish, and Vice Chair Fagan, and members of the committee. My name is Andy Smith. I'm here today testifying on behalf of the Association of Oregon Counties. And good news from the county world, and that is that we've created a standalone veterans committee. We're no longer a subcommittee. We're one of eight policy committees at AOC, so we're right along AOC, right along the committees at AOC that would do transportation, economic development, water issues, land use, all of those things. Veterans have become elevated in terms of our radar of issues, and so we're very excited to do that work with you, and that just happened in December. So I'm here today testifying in support of House Bill 423 and 4 points I'd like to make. One, the point was really best made by the Marine in terms of the need. Clearly, this is an opportunity to grow those resources, whether it be more of these resource individuals on our community college campuses, whether it be longer hours. When she testified, they're not open on the weekends or in the evenings. Clearly, the need is there, so we are excited about to be able to support that. We also think it's an opportunity to bring attention. As you know, the war is not over. We've got our National Guard units that are going back this summer to continue to serve in a war environment. We also think in terms of the focus, the mission that this does in terms of education as a core area, it's getting that access, that entry to the education, it's succeeding in the education, and it's that workforce piece. So, I think the discussion here today, all of the community college testimony was a testament that that's going to work, that we have a model in place that we want to build on that. And then I'd like to end. This is an example of the kind of partnership that the counties would like to do with the state and with you. This is really a community-based approach, and whether, you know, we brought along another partner in this particular realm, but moving forward, there are all kinds of opportunities where the partnership between counties and the state can be crucial, and we just want to be here to continue to, you know, a lot of the momentum came from ODVA, and we want to recognize that and support their work and support the bill.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate your testimony today. Are there any questions before we allow him to leave? Seeing none, thank you, sir. Appreciate that, and thanks for the support of the AOC. And I believe our intent, we're going to hold this over into the next meeting and schedule. Is that what we're doing? Yes, 4023.
Because of the possibility of the additional amendments, yes.
Exactly. Thank you. Okay, so we will close. Cameron Smith, did you sign up to testify on this? I'm not sure if you used a Sharpie and it didn't bleed through, but sir, it's always a pleasure to have you come forward. It's our privilege, and please do.
Good afternoon, Chair Matthews, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cameron Smith, Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and please remind me not to follow the testimony of my fellow Marine from PCC in the future. That was a powerful statement, both of support of our veterans and our military families, and specifically on this bill. It's a pleasure to be back before you, and a pleasure to see a number of concepts coming forward in this short session in February in support of our veterans and their families. And if I had to call out one general theme that I am seeing from the bills that have posted to date, it is the theme of opportunity, both across education and employment of our veterans and our military families. And I do not need to remind this committee the strength that our veterans and military families bring, whether they served 4 years, whether they served over 20 years, the leadership, the skills, the core values that they earned through their service pays huge dividends back here at the federal, state, and county level. But also, it's a very challenging reintegration that we know for our veterans when they do come back home. It is very much a transition for them to navigate. And ODVA is proud to partner with the National Guard at a leadership level across the state of Oregon to provide that guidance and support. but we know that our veterans and their families will thrive in Oregon only if we have these broader partnerships that we're talking about. And House Bill 4023 is truly walking the talk of that partnership. ODVA is proud to have a strong partnership with CCWD, community colleges at the state level, along with the 17 community colleges based regionally across this great state. More veterans and our service members are on campus than ever before, both the Iraq and Afghanistan generation, as well as adult learners. So I think appropriate that these funds are channeled through community colleges. $120 million in educational benefits flowing from the feds through the GI Bill to veterans, student veterans in the state of Oregon. We have a very generous, robust post-9/11 bill that includes both that tuition side and wraparound benefits around housing and books in addition to tuition. And I think it's important for us to think, what is that state and county and local and community role, given the vast amount of federal VA resources on that scholarship, on that GI Bill opportunity for our veterans? And I think our responsibility at the state and local level is still significant, ensuring that we are getting the positive outcomes for those. This is a massive investment by this nation in our veterans and our military families, and we need to make sure that our campuses are receptive to these folks coming back and that we're getting them the additional skills, knowledge, and educational outcomes that provide access for their careers going forward. And as we heard today, some of the best practices bubbling up, both at OSU with Gus Bedwell, at PCC, at Clackamas, and our other community colleges. The veteran resource coordinator on campus as a center of gravity, as a member of the community college staff, and, you know, I kind of phrase, they're an advocate, they're an advisor, they're a trainer, they're a mentor, they're a connector to resources, and they're also that peer-to-peer support that's essential for our veterans. What I want to emphasize is kind of the shift. You know, the Campus Veteran Service Officer Program, when we piloted that previously, both from leadership with ODVA and through this committee, that circuit rider mentality and having a formal claims presence, there was a tension. The claims process works right now. You know, the state of Oregon through ODVA and our county partners with those county veteran service officers, those are the experts on that formal power of attorney claim going up to the federal government and the federal VA, whether on access to the extensive health care benefits or also on the disability pension and claims. So this model of veteran resource coordinator is not necessarily submitting those claims. So there's a strong guidance both from the governor, the legislature, our veterans community, and the citizens that we don't want to duplicate services. We are going to continue to invest in that county veteran service office function that is very much that claims-driven, as well as being the larger belly button center of gravity in their community. But we found with this best practice bubbling up on the veterans resource coordinator, having folks on campus that are county veteran service officers can link to and partner, it's just a tremendous, you know, you have someone that is catching that extended hand on the outreach. So we're excited. The model is powerful, as you heard from the other testimony. We're excited to further encourage and enhance the support for our student veterans. And I would just simply emphasize, this is not simply for the troops, but actually ends up strengthening the community colleges in achieving their educational outcomes for this one leg of the diverse population that they're serving. So happy to take any questions, and thank you for your time.
Thanks for yours, and thanks for all your work for Oregon veterans. Really appreciate it. Any questions?
Just yes. A related comment. I'm going to let Cameron off the hook, but last year when we were dealing with the issue, I talked to Dr. Frank Tota, who is the president of Columbia Gorge Community College, and he said he really, really misses having that veteran services officer or the coordinator on the campus. They were well used, even though that campus had a shared person that split their time by, I think, three campuses or something like that. But it was something that's very much missed. And also, from a point of the work that we have done in the past, and I'm not casting aspersions or anything, but I think we would probably see better results out of Senate Bill 275, which is advising returning veterans that they can qualify for college credits on their military training and schooling. but they have to be advised, and they have to know about it, and they have to know who to contact. And I think this bill could help get the people on the campus in the place that can help move veterans toward the benefits of 275.
I agree. Any further questions or comments? Cameron, thanks. Always a pleasure. Thank you very much. And with that, we have nobody else signed up to testify on House Bill 4023, so we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4023. And are we ready to proceed with House Bill 4031?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4031 relocates the State Interoperability Executive Council from the Oregon Department of Transportation to the Oregon Department of Administrative Services, and it conforms language to that end. It updates legislative findings to acknowledge the ongoing nature of concern for public safety communications infrastructure and to incorporate requirements for Department of Homeland Security grant eligibility. It modifies the membership of the SIEC, operative January 2, 2016. It updates the SIEC's responsibilities to require it to meet eligibility requirements for DHS grants, that is, Department of Homeland Security grants, not to be confused with Human Services. Advise the governor and report to the legislature. It requires DAS employ a statewide interoperability coordinator to perform specified duties. It has an effective date of July 1st, 2014. Has a fiscal light and no revenue impact with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Great. Thank you. We'll have Patrick Singh, and is it Tom? Is it Loud?
Lauer.
Lauer?
R.
It's R. Sorry, Mr. Lauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Patrick Singh. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. I want to first thank Representative Parrish, Senator Johnson, for their work on the bill, their service on the State Interoperability Executive Council, and for their work continued on this bill. And, of course, thank you also to Representative Boone for her chief sponsoring of the bill and longtime work in emergency preparedness. This is essentially what the bill is about. So the SIEC was formed after 9/11, work on the issue of public safety interoperability, with major changes both at the federal and state level, coming with FirstNet interoperability network and next generation 911 service. It's important for local government and the state to partner together to make sure that these transitions happen smoothly as we move to new technology. With this bill, we've determined that the Department of Administrative Services, specifically the Chief Information Office, has the best capability to manage the projects and funding coming down the road. On the SIEC, we have a number of state agencies that are involved, and many local government interests, public safety, and special districts. On the county side specifically, we have sheriffs, county commissioner, public safety, communications officials. Currently, Sherman County Commissioner Mike Smith is on the SIEC and has, through his leadership, we've supported this bill unanimously through AOC. Leading this effort from the very beginning was Yamhill County Commissioner Kathy George. Her leadership, we passed Senate Bill 665 last session unanimously through the Senate Veterans Emergency Preparedness Committee. Due to some unforeseen issues, we weren't able to get it through the Ways and Means process, but since last session, the various state agencies involved and our local partners have worked with legislative fiscal to work out all the kinks. So thank you to Tom Lauer and his staff, of course, at the Department of Transportation for their work. Tom's going to explain some more of the mechanics of the bill. So we present to you House Bill 4031, which we believe is a true housekeeping cleanup bill from the 2013 session.
Thank you. Mr. Lauer.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Tom Lauer, Chief Engineer, Oregon Department of Transportation, Chair, members of the committee. I'm pleased to come here in support of House Bill 4031. It accomplishes several major housekeeping energy roles. One, clarifying the role of the SAIC as it bears towards all forms of emergency communication, both voice and mobile data. It modifies the membership of the SAIC so that it is better positioned to support mobile data into the future, which is a critical new development within the industry. It establishes the SAIC as the primary stakeholder and support for the governor when it comes to some critical decisions related to mobile data that the federal government will put to the state as a part of the FirstNet Mobile Data Communications Program. It establishes the SWCC as the support person for the SAIC. It transfers the FirstNet, not the state radio project, to DAS, particularly to the CIO office within DAS, who is best positioned to help lead that effort into the future, and moves the staff within ODOT that are supporting that over to DAS as well. At that, I'm open to any questions you might have.
Thank you. Any questions? Quick, easy fix, huh? So a nice little housekeeping effort, and we appreciate the testimony. Thank you both for joining us today. Okay. And with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 4031 and open a work session on House Bill 4031.
Chair Matthews, I move House Bill 4031 to the floor with a do pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Thank you very much. And I just had that. I gave you mine. Representative Fagan moves House Bill 4031 to the floor with a do pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Yes.
Well, I'll just say, you know, Betsy Johnson is a rock star on this. She's worked on this for years. She worked on it before I came to the legislature. And so it's just, you know, I'm excited to see this move forward this session, and kudos to her for, you know, being so diligent. We definitely need radio and communication that speak to each other across the state for some of the reasons we heard earlier today about, you know, the other bill that came forward. So anyway, just a huge shout out to Betsy for continuing to steer this.
Thank you, Vice Chair Parrish. Well done. Any further discussion? Any further discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll, please.
Representative Boone.
Aye.
Representative Esquivel.
Aye.
Representative Huffman.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Vice Chair Fagan.
Aye.
Vice Chair Parrish.
Aye.
Chair Matthews.
Aye. And the motion passes. We don't need a carrier because we're sending that over to Ways and Means. Wonderful. Look at that. How efficient. And I still don't see Dr. Holliday, but we're going to move on to House Bill. We're going to open up a, I'm sorry, close the work session on House Bill 4031. And we will open up a public hearing on House Bill 4087.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4087 establishes a 13-member task force on school safety comprised of two non-voting legislators, one senator and one representative, an Oregon State Police representative, Department of Public Safety Standards and Training representative, and nine others from or appointed by the governor's office, primarily related to education and law enforcement. Sets forth areas of task force concern, including establishment, maintenance, and use of a database by OSP containing floor plans of all Oregon schools, development of a coordinated statewide training for school personnel with other first responders, and studying the efficacy and standardized incident response. It directs a task force to organization to mirror our legislative model. They typically run like committees. And requires a report to a Judiciary Legislative Committee on the school floor plan by September 1st of this year and on the training and standardized incident response by October 1st of 2015. It requires OSP to provide this task force with staff, requires OSP to provide statutory travel expenses, appropriates general funds to OSP for task force purposes, sunsets the task force upon the opening of the 2017 legislative session, declares emergency is effective on passage. There is no revenue impact, and there is a fiscal impact.
Thank you so much. And we're joined with the superintendent, the sheriff, and the chief. Thank you so much, gentlemen. If you want to start in whatever order you'd like and identify yourselves for the record, and we'll begin.
Well, thank you very much, Chair Matthews and members of the committee. I'm Sheriff Craig Roberts with Clackamas County Sheriff's Office. And I'm here today representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association to support House Bill 4087, along with my colleagues here, OSP Superintendent Richard Evans and City of Beaverton Chief Jeff Spaulding, representing the Oregon Association of Chiefs Police. Together, we believe that we need a statewide task force on school safety that will bring schools and law enforcement together to develop statewide response standards and training for critical incidents on school campuses. Today, Oregon lacks a comprehensive statewide standard that will enable schools to develop efficient policies and procedures to interface with law enforcement to rapidly respond to shooters or other critical incidents at schools.
Well, I must say that there are many schools, districts, and local law enforcement agencies that have developed coordinated response plans and are working well together. Others are yet to start that conversation. We believe that the creation of a task force on school safety is vital to secure the safety of Oregon schools across the state. I just want to talk briefly about how the idea got started to bring law enforcement and schools together to look at a coordinated statewide response to school safety. In February 2013, Superintendent Evans and I were invited to Washington, D.C. that focused on looking at bringing together individuals across the country that had suffered tragedies such as Sandy Hook, Virginia Tech, and others. And there was a focus on emergency plans for schools throughout our country. Before our visit to D.C., the active shooter incident had occurred at the Clackamas Town Center, and on December 11, 2012, two individuals were killed and another individual was seriously injured. 3 days later, on December 14, 2012, the tragedy at Sandy Hook happened. And I shared with Superintendent Evans in our conversation our agency's response to the town center. We determined that there were really three critical components that grounded our ability to deploy effectively and efficiently on that particular day. And it had to do with access to site plans. We had immediate access to building floor plans, mall infrastructure that was critical to our rapid deployment. We had trained on mall campus along with personnel. And another key element had to do with communication. We had pre-identified key points of contact for our agency and mall personnel, and we had a communication plan in place. So Superintendent Evans and I shared the concern with Oregon schools as we sat and talked that we were not as well prepared if the situation would sadly occur at one of our schools. Our conversation really after the trip to the White House, we came back, and I will say it was very compelling for both of us to hear the testimony of what had happened, and collectively wanted to make sure that we were doing everything within our power, within our district, to really make sure we're doing the best job to protect our kids if sadly this happened in our county. So we brought together a task force in our county, which included local police, fire department, state police, and the FBI. But as we looked at that solution here with our county, suddenly I realized that I was also getting calls throughout the state that other law enforcement agencies and schools were trying to do the very same thing. And I think that's what really brought it to our attention, that it is much a larger issue than just in Clackamas County. None of us were communicating centrally, that there was no standardization, and it became clear on the statewide effort to develop a comprehensive approach. And I think what's shocking to me is knowing that there's over 1,248 schools in our state, K through 12, and over 560,000 kids believe that we really all do need to work together to protect our children. And I believe that's exactly what this House Bill 4087 will do, so I'm asking you to support me in this, representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association on this important bill, and help us keep our kids safe in school. So now at this time, I'd like to turn it over to Beaverton Police Chief Jeff Smalley.
Thank you, Sheriff Roberts. Chair Matthews, Vice Chairs Parrish and Fagan, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Spaulding. I'm the police chief in the city of Beaverton, representing not only Beaverton, but the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, in our strong support for the passage of HB 4087. I can tell you that in my 5 years in the state of Oregon and the city of Beaverton, coming from another state, that one of the things I really appreciate is our high level of cooperation, communication, and coordination and partnership that we share not only with other law enforcement agencies, but also with our school districts. This has become very important to us, and this is now an opportunity for us to take school safety to the next level. Clearly, it's important that we have a very quick and effective response to on-campus incidents. Recent FBI studies have told us that we've seen a tenfold increase in active shooter type incidents from the years 2000 to 2012. These are pretty dangerous numbers. The response time for law enforcement response is anywhere from 2 to 3 minutes, and unfortunately, by that time, in many cases, the damage has already been done, and the active shooting incident is actually over at that point. The passage of this particular House bill does give us an opportunity to increase our response time and hopefully decrease some of the potential damage that can be done. Most jurisdictions are attempting to prepare for the possibility, as we do in Beaverton and many other jurisdictions, for an on-campus incident, but this is being done in isolation. So again, this is an opportunity for us all to work together and have some mutual coordination. The coordination of law enforcement personnel, fire personnel, ambulance services, and school employees prior to an event occurring is imperative. The passage of HB 47 will create a task force which will address such things such as common nomenclature for all first responders, fire, schools, and police often do train separately. Also to result in a coordinated effort on a statewide level, and it will create a statewide mapping project which would include photos of the school along with a map and floor plans, aerial elevations of the school, tactical plans for each school accessible by all first responders. This would include predetermined entry points to the schools, inner and outer perimeters, pre-designated locations for command posts, EMS, media, parents gathering points, etc. Our commitment to school safety alone, just in Beaverton alone, I can tell you that the Beaverton Schools District has over 51 schools serving just less than 40,000 students with 4,500 staff. Basically a mid-sized city. They serve Beaverton, some schools in Portland, some areas in the county, and actually one in Hillsboro. I actually have two of my school resource officers here today. We have six school resource officers. We provide a high level of service to our community along with one supervisor. We've done site assessments. We've done mapping in the city of Beaverton. But again, this fails to address the fact that oftentimes we expect that other jurisdictions will also respond into our community, and we will also respond to those jurisdictions. Clearly, this is again an opportunity for us to improve these mutual responses. With the passage of with the assistance of the legislature and the passage of HB 47, a task force can be launched, and a statewide mapping project, as I mentioned earlier, can be initiated, similar to the one in the state of Washington. Again, I keep talking about opportunity, but I do see this as an opportunity to take our commitment to the next level, and I would encourage everybody that we get everybody, especially our first responders, on the same page in the interest of student safety. So again, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Chief. Superintendent Evans.
Chair Matthews, co-chairs, vice chairs Fagan and Parrish. My name is Richard Evans, and I'm the superintendent of the Oregon State Police. Some things that struck me very clearly: we train for these type of incidents, but we never want them to happen. When I was at the Clackamas Town Center with Sheriff Roberts, we had officers self-dispatching from agencies near and far. In fact, we had so many officers coming, we couldn't keep track of them all. But the one thing that I could that concerned me the most from that event was I was standing watching everybody run out of the building and all the police officers running into the building, is that this is one isolated incident where we've trained for Clackamas County. We need to pick up our game. We need to think about how we're going to do this on a statewide level, and we need to protect our most valuable resource, our children. And so Craig and I entered into, Sheriff Roberts entered into many conversations. We went back to D.C., and I started researching what other states were doing and what other opportunities we could bring. As Chief Spaulding has said, the chiefs, the sheriffs, and the state police try to work together on these issues because it is a statewide issue. When I knew that Sheriff Roberts was training his folks in Clackamas County, I had to worry about the other 35 counties across the state where troopers were going to be deployed. And I want to make sure we train successfully to make these responses go as smoothly as we can. I learned that the state of Washington was light years ahead of us. They have mapped every school in the state of Washington, and the maps are accessible through the internet to the teachers and law enforcement across the state. They have over 7,000 users that are able to log onto that system as they respond to these incidents, and they've already went through joint training with schools and the police. As I started looking at these things, all the concerns that I had when I was at Clackamas Town Center, some of those were alleviated through these planning processes and the coordination of efforts with the teachers and law enforcement. We, as we look forward, there's so many advantage is for us to move toward a statewide protocol so that we have the terminology that the chief talked about. Where are the safe rooms in the school? Is it a lockdown school? Is it a school that as everybody flee, do they go to certain areas? As a law enforcement officer, if I'm going to be entering a school, as Sheriff Roberts talked about, so many schools, the only resource available to me is something that we put together and advance this. The task force approach will bring everybody to the table. If law enforcement is the only one training without the teachers, school administrations, the school boards, the EMS folks, the parents, where are the parents going to go if this incident happens? We're missing the boat, and so it's extremely important to bring everybody together. We also feel the need that the schools in Oregon need to be the most safest environment that we have. As we look forward, we invest in the schools, the students, and making sure their education. I want the folks, citizens of Oregon, to know that law enforcement takes this as one of their top priorities, and we are going to do everything possible to protect our most vulnerable resource and our most important resource, the children. One of the things that the state of Washington has done is they mapped the elementary schools first. They have moved on from there to post-secondary education to the universities and and to the community colleges, which is starting right now. There's also applications that we could, if we started this program in Oregon, we could take it to another level. We could also do the schools. Then we have large gathering areas like the Rose Garden, University of Oregon. You have other opportunities to map for these type of events as we move forward. This is kind of a, you know, Sheriff Roberts really talked about listening to the victims and listening to the officers back east and how they wish they would have prepared at certain levels for different incidents. We're here as a group to ask you for your assistance with this bill and to move Oregon into the future so that we can respond to the best of our ability when these incidents ever happen again. I hope you support this bill, and I appreciate the time being here today.
Thank you, sir, and thank you, gentlemen, for all three being a part. I know how busy your lives are, and it makes a strong statement that you're here, and I'm sure if Craig Jenninger knew you were here, he'd say hi, so I'll see him at a council meeting.
Yes, thank you.
Any questions? Yes, Mr. Fagan.
Just a comment. I remember at the end of the full session when Sheriff Roberts came and talked to me first about this idea, and it was past all the deadlines for bills and everything, so I'm glad to see that it worked out to become a committee bill for the Judiciary Committee, because this is an important issue. Obviously, I'm a mom, and so this is one of the things that there's nothing that I want more than to know that when my son is at school that we're doing everything we can to make sure that he's going to be safe. And so I appreciate that you guys kept working at it and that we found a vehicle through which we can get this through.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, who else do we have signed up to testify on this bill?
We have Tricia Smith.
Okay. I appreciate you guys doing this. Last session, there was a lot of work, a lot of talk done about how do we protect our kids, school mm-hmm. safety, and this really seems like a reasonable, high-level approach where we can get a good group of folks together. That represent schools and law enforcement and whatnot, and head down a good path for planning. So, thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In addition to mapping, can you give us a feel for some of the other best practices that perhaps other states have put into play?
Go ahead first. Well, I think as far as Superintendent Evans talked about, I think one of the other best practices that I saw in the state of Washington also included other high-risk facilities that we could also put in there. It could be, you know, something like Tektronix that might be a potential threat in our communities or anything else, is being able to map those kinds of things, because one of the big lessons that I really took away is a lesson learned from a lot of the researchers and stuff. This is all about time. We will save lives when it comes down to response and time. And so it's not the time to sort it out. And I think what was an eye-opener for me as well is that people are going to come far and wide to help.
And everybody, that the more people we can have that see that plan of what we're responding into, gives us a better idea about how we can deploy resources. If we have a secondary staging location for where kids happen to be moving to, we can also make sure that we're putting good security to that direction to protect those kids as
yes.
well. So I see it as just have a multitude of things. I will say, and this is, I'm going to, a little plug, that in Colorado, there's a I Love You Guys Foundation, and it was a result of a school shooting there. And basically, that was also getting everybody on the same terminology, because people were using different terms. What's lockdown? What's lockout?
Yeah.
Having the teachers, us, all speaking that same language to make sure that we know what we have to deal with, and then being trained on that same thing. So.
Can answer a couple. Chair Matthews, Representative Witt, some of the things that are being discussed because people are taking it a little further are simple things like fire code doesn't allow a lock on the inside of a door of a school schoolroom where a teacher can lock the door. Those discussions can be advanced because it's against the fire code, okay? And so that's one of the best practices that people are talking about. The other one's the establishment of safe rooms with inside schools that can be locked in. And so is it a safe school? Is a lockdown in place? How? And so this discussion's going forward, and you can't have that discussion unless you have everybody at the table to have that. And so that's the extreme importance of it, and I believe it's evolving. I think there's a lot of different tactics that can come out of bringing people together to put the best practices forward, but it's clear that those conversations have to be with everybody at the table, and that's why the task force approach is the way we decided that would be the best opportunity.
Members of the committee, what I would just like to add is I can't necessarily speak to what other states are doing ahead of us, but I am very proud of what the state of Oregon is already doing. And, you know, we really truly do take a multidisciplinary, multi-hazard approach to this, and there's so many elements involved in here in terms of training not only the law enforcement responding for all the first responders, but also working very closely with the schools, with the teachers, the students, the parents, you know, so many different levels that we have to work on in terms of hitting all the different approaches. So there's a lot of things we actually do very well, and I'm very proud to say that. Again, this is, again, some opportunity to tie up some loose ends and make sure that we, you know, kind of close that loop on the, again, the multi-agency communication piece of this. And one last thing I would like to just, for the record, is to correct. I didn't want to mislead the members here in terms of the FBI statistics. When I talk about a tenfold increase from 2000 to 2012, that's accurate, but that's not just schools. That's all active shooter type incidents. Approximately 30% of that number is actually in the schools. Still very tragic, but again, I didn't
yes.
want to mislead anybody.
Well, I thank you very much for your answers, and thank you very much for taking this project on and for showing leadership. It's greatly appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you. One of the questions I have, certainly, I think, you know, school shootings top of mind. We see that in the media. But is it going to be in the purview, do you think, of this group to also talk about other types of school safety inside the physical environment? When you talk about door locks and things, but yes. I used to run a food service program, and it was not easy to convince parents that we needed to have locks on our refrigerators. Or, you know, so there's other, for safety reasons, and not just because somebody's going to go grab a milk, but somebody could just walk in and, you know, you have something what happened in Antelope, you know, 20 years ago or so. So we're going to look at the full school environment for all types of kinds of, emergency crisis response, or are we just really focused on kind of the gun violence piece?
So, Chair Matthews, Representative Parrish, great question. One of the things that we talked about was, as we move forward, the discussions that you just had, how are we going to get to that point? I think I've lost my train of thought for just a second. I apologize. What was the question again? I'm sorry.
Just the rest of the school environment and school safety. And, you know, in this, like I said, the scenario I can envision and used to have to kind of go around in my school district was, you know, if the refrigerators aren't locked and, somebody coming through the side door and you've got lunch pre-prepared for a bunch of kids, I mean, that's a safety issue in my mind. Yes. So looking at that total environment for all manner of type of potential responses and not, I mean, obviously the one that's top of mind is the one we hear about, but I think there's other certainly security issues that go into school. So I'm hoping that this is more robust conversation.
Yes. I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought.
That's
site
okay.
assessment is one of the issues that we discussed early. So what happens now is a school is built, and then their law enforcement is called in to assess how safe this building is. We would like to further discuss the floor plans and the blueprints of the buildings as law enforcement response for a safer approach, so that when we're moving forward, the discussion is law enforcement, schools, everybody comes together prior to discuss these issues before the buildings are built. A lot of the new schools simply have big roundabouts where a person can actually drive right into the school. We want to take this to another level so that everything we do about school safety, from door locks to placements of entry points, is all strategically thought about before it ever moves past the point of being too late. So it is a further conversation. We tried to narrow the scope a little bit from the beginning to make sure that we can get something accomplished, but it has definitely been discussed in detail on how we move forward getting farther into the safety protocols of the schools. Extremely important. It's a great question.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Let me just say, as a father of three school-aged children and also a longtime public safety person, I started police in 87, left of the fire department in 98. I'm currently the interim chief with Gresham. I've got a battalion chief working with a police captain on an active shooter scenario in our grade schools. And let me just tell you how disturbing that is to admit that that's where we're at in school today. I appreciate the work of the school resource officers and what you do. There was a time when law enforcement put officers in the school to be the conduit for the school. Now they are the security, and they are everything. And there's a huge expectation on you in those schools, and I know you don't take that lightly. But again, the three of you here today showing how important this is to your community, we take it seriously too. Now, we're not going to move this bill today, but our intent is it will move. And you have strong support from the chair. We do have one other person who wants to testify today, but let me just say on behalf of the committee, thanks for taking time today. Very meaningful and powerful.
Thank you.
You can listen to the last person. And if we could please have Tricia Smith from OSEA, please. How are you today?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association. OSEA is a public sector, public and private sector union of 20,000 classified school employees, predominantly working in K-12 schools, but not exclusively in Oregon. We are here to wholeheartedly support House Bill 4087. With a couple of tweaks, please. And to tell you, we are so happy that the legislature is taking up the issue of school safety and what we need to do and think about in order to make our school buildings as safe as they can possibly be at all times. The tweaks that I mentioned a moment ago are minor, and they involve my members. This task force at this point has everyone on it that should be on it, except the classified school employees, who are often the very first people that anyone entering a school building meet, who have the most intimate knowledge of those buildings, who also teach children, who involve almost half the personnel in schools. And they have an expertise that's very important to the work of this task force. So one of the tweaks that we would ask you to make to this bill, and the chair has very kindly offered to allow us to draft, is to add a member of Oregon School Employees Association to the task force. The other tweak that I have not specifically spoken to the chair about, but the more I look at it, the more it worries me, is on page 2 of the bill, in line 6, and again in line 9 and 10, it speaks to training of school administration officials. We think that terminology may be a little restrictive, Again, there are a whole lot of people besides school administrative officials. I don't believe the sponsors of this bill meant to be exclusive in their language, but understanding that statute's statute, we suggest that you modify that language to say school employees on in both of those lines, or in all three of those lines that I just mentioned. And with that, we wholeheartedly support the bill, and we hope you will move it forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Ms. Satinsbiel.
Hey, Lori Satinsbiel for the Oregon School Boards Association. I wasn't going to testify, but I thought there's a couple of things that came up. Scope, design of buildings, and I love you guys. OSBA.
Thank you.
Love you guys. For the past couple years, we put on a safety conference, and I love you guys came out and testified and spoke, and we had a really, really great response to that. So I love you guys. That's good.
That's a lobby
technique I have.
We have been at OSBA. We've sent a couple of our staff members to several safety conferences to try to get a handle on best practices. And scope, meaning we want to go to design of buildings. We've involved some safety folks in designs and long-range facility plannings for districts who are maybe going out for bonds and they're going to do a major renovation, and what kind of safety features would we add at this point. So I'm very excited about this, that we can incorporate all the folks that need to be involved in training everyone on, you know, how we're going to handle active shooters. If someone is trying to steal the milk, we'll get them too.
Let's not steal the milk. It was go in and hurt the food supply. Sorry.
Got it.
Let me make myself clear.
So with that, I just wanted to, you know, support for this as well in any way we can be helpful to move this along.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I think the plan is to give this thing about a day to figure out just what exactly you know, the amendment would look like and how that would be drafted. It won't change the scope of the work of the task force. I think it's just a matter of, you know, governor's public safety advisor and a couple of key others in judiciary that had this plan. Are they going to start seeing this group build? I'll also tell you and suggest that I got a call from a parent from a PTSO group who wonders why a parent group's not associated. Now, if you've been part of large assemblies, like maybe 60 people, sometimes nothing gets done if there's too many. And then oftentimes a lot of good work gets done. So I just want to make sure that we're within the scope. What I don't want to do and what I won't do is delay this from progress in this February session. This work is critical, and getting it out there, we'll get it done. So we're working with it. We'll see what we can do, and look forward to finding resolve here. Thank you. Any questions? Yes.
Well, just a comment. You know, Trisha, I actually really do appreciate you bringing forward that piece. When you think about a school and the design of a school, and somebody who, no matter whether it's, you know, poison lunch or, you know, wants to shoot the school or blow up the school or whatever, the first people they're going to encounter is the secretary at the door. If they're coming in through a side door or through the cafeteria, they're going to see your lunch ladies. If they're out on the playground, they're going to, you know, be an IA who's doing supervising recess. Or if they're walking down a hall, you know, it's going to be the janitor. So those are those kind of, before anybody gets to a classroom, those are the layers of people who are kind of the eyes and ears of the building. So I really do, I think that's a critical point when we talk about training and involvement, that and just know that those are folks who are in their own school system, sometimes not necessarily the first top of mind people as that people are doing planning, and yet that's kind of the hub of how the facility is working. And so to not have that voice in there, I think, is a mistake. So I appreciate you bringing that forward and catching that.
My only concern was, again, span of control if this thing were to grow. Also, the freelancing, if somebody starts self-dispatching into the arena, those things in an ICS command structure can be troubling. So we want to make sure that we keep this thing, you know, tight and on message and on point so they can continue the good work. And appreciate both your testimonies, and we'll see how we can do this for you. Thank you. And I think there's nobody else signed up to testify on House Bill 4087. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4087. And we will open up a public hearing on House Bill 4021.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4021 requires public universities and community colleges to charge in-state tuition of graduate veterans with either an honorable discharge or general discharge under honorable conditions if their physical presence is shown in Oregon within 12 months of enrollment. This will sound very familiar to this committee because it was House Bill 2158 in the last session that moved to provide for in-state tuition for undergraduate veterans, so this is an expansion. There was a fiscal light and no revenue impact. There was a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you, and I see we have Mr. Holliday here. Dr. Holliday, thanks for joining us. And just so you are aware, I know how hard you worked with us on 2158, and we were able to do it point forward to help remove the fiscal. I know that this hasn't been done yet in this particular bill, and I know that our goal is to try to make this as clear as possible, much like we did with 2158 with your work. I'm going to step outside briefly, so I will pass this to Vice Chair Fagan. Thank you, sir.
All right. Vice Chair Fagan, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joe Holliday. I serve the Oregon University system as the assistant vice chancellor for student success initiatives. I almost gave myself a promotion there. I was going to go summarize some of the current veterans benefits that we provide, but I see such familiar faces here, I don't think that's necessary. I think you're all quite aware of. In fact, I think many of the benefits we provide emanated from this committee and from this chamber, so I think I'll skip that part. We're supportive of this bill. It seems like the logical next step that extends the exemption of non-resident tuition rates to graduate students, but I would be remiss if I didn't share some concern on the part of my colleagues at the institutions about the cumulative effect of the various waivers, discounts, and exemptions at a time when they are increasingly dependent on tuition revenue, so and especially non-resident tuition revenue. So that's the only concern that I would raise from the campuses. As I think you know, resident tuition rates for Oregon are generally set below the actual cost of instruction, whereas our non-resident tuition rates are set above the cost of instruction, enable us to take the pressure off the need to increase our resident tuition rates. So that's the only concern that we have. A final point. Our graduate programs, as you may know, have lower capacity and they're more selective in the sense that there are many more applicants for the available spots. So the idea of attracting non-resident veterans will have less of an effect here as it would for the undergraduate students. So that's it.
All right. Any questions or comments for this gentleman? Yes, Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Joe, have you done any preliminary estimation on how many students you think in the next biennium that this might affect? Have you had a chance to do that?
Yes, Vice Chair Fagan, Rep Huffman, members of the committee. We currently have 38 students, graduate students, who are non-resident veteran students in our graduate programs, and our fiscal that we are compiling right now is based on those 38 students. We're not sure how many students this benefit would attract. We're aware that there is a piece of federal legislation that just made it through the House H.R. 357, that would make this a national thing. It would require all the states to do this, so we might not be attracting more students. So it probably would be a relatively small number of students.
Any further comments or questions? Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
And as a final panel, I would like to call up Andy Smith and Cameron Smith. Please state your name for the record and let us know if there's any family connection with those very unusual last names that end up being similar here.
I will claim all relation there. Andy Smith on behalf of the Association of Oregon Counties. The counties wanted to go on record in support of this bill, moving in the right direction. And I don't know if this is connected, but I thought I heard that Oregon, it was the number one move-in state. I mean, it's in terms of where people are moving. So there certainly is a wave of people that are coming to Oregon, but we would want to, in particular, welcome our vets that are coming here, and this seems to be consistent with a lot of the things that you've been doing. So we hope that you can support the bill.
Vice Chair Fagan and Vice Chair Parrish, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cameron Smith, Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and just want to thank Joe Holliday again. Walking the talk of partnership, both with our community colleges and the universities, is what will drive success for our veterans and their families. Again, want to reiterate, we'll go through the a bill back in Congress, H.R. 357, the GI Bill, Tuition Fairness Act of 2013. Believe it passed unanimously out of the House, and if we're reading the tea leaves, we'll get a lot of traction in the Senate back in Congress, and ranges from that mandating if coursework is being paid for by GI Bill dollars that is charged by our institutions across the nation at that in-state tuition rate, irregardless of the residency of a veteran. So, and I think it speaks to Oregon led the way on this front, both with the community colleges and the universities, and now 20 other states have it across the nation, and soon we'll have that in addition across every state. That bill also has a number of different voc rehab and other employment and education benefits that are getting extended for our veterans and their families. But we'll go through that bill with a finer tooth comb to see if it does apply to graduate work. But again, we think it's the logical next step in this committee's work. Thank you.
Are there any questions or comments for this panel? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House Bill 4021? Seeing none, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 4021. And if there's nothing else for the good of the order, I will adjourn the Veterans Services and Emergency Preparedness Committee.
Bond on them.